Well, it's important to understand the difference between graffiti art and mural art.
Yeah.
So because graffiti basically doesn't have any substance in terms of a message, while mural art is basically painting on big scale. And if you take Banksy, for example, who's a fantastic artist, his work is always saying something urgent, something important, something to think about, something that you might have been ignoring perhaps for a longest time, just pretending it's not there. So art is definitely one of the biggest changing gears of the society, and it needs to be that way. It's the conscious. I think it has to be, at least from my perspective.
So, hey everybody, I want to welcome you to the next episode in our Smithsonian on the Move collaborative episode. My name is Adam Gamwell, and I am one of the co-hosts and executive producers of this AnthroLife podcast.
I'm Ryan Collins. I am the other co-host of this AnthroLife podcast.
And I'm Leslie Walker, the project manager for the AAA's Public Education Initiative.
Now, this episode, we're going to be exploring the theme and the subject matter of art. And one of the themes that came out of a lot of the conversations we had at the Smithsonian that are going to be in this episode, but that also connected across a number of episodes, is the idea that art is hard. And because it's hard, artists should not be producing art and making art solely for money. This is a really interesting theme that, you know, ties back to the previous episode where we talked with Sumana Saleh, the West Nigerian leather worker, as well as some of the speakers, Ruben Milan, we're going to talk with today. And on into future episodes too, we're looking at ideas of technology and development.
You know, thinking about this idea that art is hard, it's not just art's hard on the producer, the creator of an object or of a mural or of any type of artistic media, but it's really hard for scholars to talk about it, to classify it, to even explore it. Anthropologists have been dealing with this issue for a very long time. When we look at the work of Stuart Blattner, he talks about how the original studies of art and objects were sort of focused on collecting and gathering, but that decontextualized the objects. It put them outside of culture, and that's a huge critique, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, as we know, art is connected to experience.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, and like when you pull it away like that, right? Some of the original art was about taxonomizing, right, and putting it into museums and saying how many pieces of art did this tribe, this group have, right? But then I think you're totally right, and that was one of the main critiques of this, is that it dehumanizes almost, right, the makers of the art, and like there's no interest in who made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see that sort of change, right, like, you know, when you try to put that context back in, then that really does deepen this question of what is art, right? What counts as art? And is it decorative? Is it formal? Is it aesthetic? Is it expressive? Is it all these things, right?
Exactly. And I mean, we think about that further, right? How art for anthropologists has tended to get into this sort of gray zone of those who want to get into art because it's an expression of culture, of learning, of tradition, of everything that would be a representation of a group. And yet at the same end, art has this stigma of being something that is completely embodying Western society and speaks to a sort of higher echelon that's totally removed, again, from so many of the producers who would lend their experience to it.
Yeah, and there's no consensus of what art is. And art is hard to make, but it's hard to define. And there's no one definition that cuts across culture. And what I observed at the festival is that no matter where art is produced or what culture it comes from, it's an expression of human creativity, imagination, skill, and it all comes together on a medium to produce works to be appreciated for their beauty, but also their emotional power. And artists produce art objects to affect the world that they live in.
That's a beautiful point. And that's what the festival on this level, in terms of the theme of art, right, really does embody, right? That it is this kind of expressive medium, but it carries such symbolism and it carries such generative connectivity. And it can be something formal that you can see, but it can be a performance, a dance, as we'll kind of talk about. The anthropologist Alfred Gell does help us think about art tends to hold this place of privilege, right? It's not really an inclusive category. So Leslie, what you're kind of pointing towards, I think, is that there is a way of inclusion in this kind of art that we're seeing at the festival that's shared and that's expressed. And so I think that's really interesting to understand what it means to be inclusive through art definitions, right? And that there can be the sort of broader category. And as we'll see, some of our speakers have their own limits they draw, their borders they draw around what they think is art and what is not art.
We look at the work of Howard Morphy and Morgan Perkins. Art is often discussed as being this broad body of knowledge and technology that represents the practices and traditions and memories of a culture, all of those things which connect and bring people together, which really impacts the whole of a community. Hmm. So when we think about art today as a movement, it's not only about bringing that community itself together, but sharing the expressions that community has to offer. Hmm. And again, we think about today, especially with art as a movement, we look at the memories that we want to have preserved, the things that we don't want to be forgotten, the things that we want to be carried on.
My name is Ruben. Actually, we pronounce it in Armenian, Ruben.
Ruben? Cool.
Ruben, with a kind of emphasis on E.
Ruben?
Actually, Spanish do it the same way.
Okay.
So it's quite a common name in Spain, yep, too, and in the Latin world. And I'm from Yerevan, Armenia. Mm-hmm. I'm trained as a painter and graphic artist, and I work as a freelance art director. Mm. I also teach a visual communication course at American University of Armenia, and drawing at the College of Art.
So it's important to note that Ruben's work is meant to evoke feeling and emotion, but also this call to act. And he's very passionate about Armenian calligraphy, which is an ancient script that's not widely used in the country today. The Armenian alphabet was created in 405 AD, and it quickly became stylized. And shortly after, all of the books in the 16th century featured this beautiful script, where you can see the graceful skill that comes from pen strokes. And we learned that Armenian calligraphy and handwriting in general is losing prominence due to computer-mediated communication. Ruben has used his artwork as engaging visuals as protest pieces, and most recently in 2018, they were used to protest against the then Prime Minister, Sir Sargsyan. Earlier, you were speaking about the postcards that you're selling in the marketplace, and how exactly does that reflect your experience as an Armenian and your movement and even here coming to DC?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's this recent and non-violent revolution that occurred in Armenia as it was also a revolution for me, because it was the first time that I produced art as we went along with the movement. It's incredible what has happened in Armenia. I mean, like, at this point, we don't even understand it fully. How profound is the change that occurred that seemed absolutely impossible just a year or 2 years ago. But I started to produce graphic posters, like, in a big scale, so that people could hold them during when we were closing intersections in the city or trying to paralyze traffic. And it actually worked because we used no violence and that disarmed the opposition. But it's a revolution because I also applied calligraphy on big scale. So and now I printed some postcards, and it's nice, just like, they're small, but they're still powerful because of the message.
And these protests, they culminated not in a violent revolution, but what's being called a velvet revolution. Mm-hmm. And again, not that this was soft, but there's a lot of emotion and impact with this. The former president had served for 2 5-year terms and then transitioned immediately into a role as a prime minister. And this left people feeling very uncomfortable. So one of the ways that Ruben has been able to showcase is protest has been through this medium, right? And by using non-violent means of protest through art. And one of his other projects is that of the Armenian Genocide posters. And these posters, they seek to bring back the notion of memory that was tied to the Armenian Genocide. And this was the very first large-scale genocide that happened in the 20th century. It was even a speaking point amongst the Nazis and with Hitler personally that no one remembered Armenia. So for a number of artists today, they find this and see this as a means to not only revitalize knowledge about a people in the past, but to draw a community together through nonviolent and peaceful forms of art production.
Yeah, and I was really struck when Ruben says that, you know, this when he started making these graphic design, these bigger posters that people could use, you know, to sort of stage demonstrations in traffic and intersections, that this is the first time that he made art. And I think that really expresses this idea that art is a movement, right? It is a powerful tool at which we express. And in this case, that we can express democracy and that we can express the people have a voice and that we can use visual representation. We can use line and color and form to bring out abstract ideas like democracy.
You know, with Ruben, we were seeing a form of art that speaks to an individual and a broader cultural movement, and it's powerful. But when we see art and performance in other settings, we see that a form and practice or a dance, a tradition, can be enacted on several different stages across cultures, effectively bridging community on a large scale that doesn't have to be centered in one place in one moment of time. And we definitely see that with the Gigantes de Catalunya. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think you're right, and that's what helps us think. In this case, like this sort of art form is reinforced by community, right? And so these gigantes are these giant puppets that people sort of put on their shoulders and walk around with. And so Leslie and I got to try these on too. They're really fun. They're playful. They're kind of, you know, animated looking. And so they're these, you know, I don't know, 25, 30 feet tall puppets made with these like kind of, you know, light wood structures that are fully clothed, and you know, they've got, you know, realized features, and they're the dresses that they're wearing have decorations on them. They've got musical notes. They've got pictures of agriculture, etc. And so these large puppets, they're called gigantes or giants, right? Mm-hmm. And these are from, we're talking about in Catalonia now, or in the northeastern part of Spain. And they have both these gigantes, these giants, as well as these quiliquis, which are these giant heads. So like that way you can just have your body, but have a really big head on. And both, again, these are animated, they're fun. And these are important elements basically of a lot of festivals that you see in mm-hmm. Catalonia. And what they do are Catalan-speaking villages, and they represent nobility. They can represent patron saints of the different towns. And so you have different gigantes depending on where you are and in which village, which town you're in. And so we get to speak with two of these puppeteers. They're both in their early 20s. It's really fun to kind of talk with Alex and Claudia, and they walked us through a bit of like what these puppets mean. And so some of this we have on tape, some of it we'll kind of talk through it.
Now, before we get to that, because you have tried on these costumes, what was it like to wear this, and how can you envision a dance taking place?
It's a great question. It's funny too, because like they're these big bodies, right? And then you see these kind of like little tiny human legs, you know, sticking out, kind of hopping around. And it was funny, like they're actually not too heavy. They're not very light because they're 30 feet tall, but they're light enough to wear. And like you kind of have, you know, this sits on your shoulders, and you kind of hold. It's like you're standing inside of a giant crutch, actually, is what it feels like. And then, you know, you can kind of walk back and forth, and like, mostly they spin because that's an easier move, you know. And it's really, the idea is like they would do these in procession. So like every day around 5 p.m. at the festival, they would put on the puppets and they would come out and they'd walk around the National Mall in a circuit. And like their musicians would go ahead of them playing tunes, and then the puppets would dance. It was always this like really fun procession, and they would have both the puppets themselves, the gigantes, the big heads, as well as they had demons that would kind of walk around, right? And those were kind of made of paper mache. So like there's a bunch of different, you know, there's wood, there's cloth, there is paper mache. And that's also how they kept them light too, because if you're wearing, you know, a 10-foot demon, it's kind of heavy, you know? and so the giganteers, the puppeteers that we spoke with, they come from the Saint Clement is the town they came from. And this is their group. And so what's interesting is that they were commissioned by a workshop. And so they have different puppeteer workshops around the regions of Catalonia. And interesting that we found out these were baptized. In this case, these puppets that we met were baptized in 1993. Hmm. So the idea of these patron saints sort of coming to life in the form of puppets, you know, also are like enmeshed in religious ideologies. They're enmeshed in cultural ideologies. One thing that really struck me, too, that we'll see is that the puppets themselves were representations of important aspects of Catalonian culture. One thing that we found out that, when I was talking with Alex and Claudia afterwards was that the two puppets that we see, we have pictures of these in the notes, is that one of them represented culture and one of them represented work. And it's like these very abstract concepts, but the way that they were made real is that on the actual dress of each of the people, there were pictures of agriculture and ceramics and even building train tracks. And these represented like the forms of work that you'd see in the village and that you'd see in Catalonia. And the culture puppet had, you know, music notes, and it had ideas of mountains where you can go see beautiful, you know, nature, and idea of holding different flowers too. And so the ideas of flowers being a very important cultural element. So it was really kind of cool to see these, you know, embodiments, as it were, this artistic embodiments of different aspects of Catalonian culture that were important to the different groups, right? And Saint Clement is one of many. There is a ton of different kinds of groups of puppets that are in Catalonia, you know, so we saw just, you know, barely scratched the surface here.
Yeah, we only saw four puppets, but it's interesting to note that this tradition of the gigantes is also seen in Valencia, Spain, but we learned from Alex and Claudia that they're also in Brazil as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's actually one of the funniest things. We learned one of the differences between the common Catalonian puppets and Brazilian is that Brazilian puppets, and some in Catalonia also, have these like floppy arms with big hands, and they would swing them, and you get like bopped by them. And it kind of hurts, they said, but it's actually good luck to get smacked by a puppet. So, you know, it's like Sesame Street gone awry, I guess, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And how during the procession, children will run out to get bopped by these puppets.
Puppet bopped. I like that. That's a good verb, I think. It was actually really cool because when we were talking with Claudia and Alex, I got to be joined again by our colleague Emma Bacque, one of the writers and head people behind the Geek Anthropologist. And so a big shout out and thanks to her for coming out and helping us do some of these interviews.
I am Alex Garcia. Mm-hmm. I am a Giants dancer of Sant Climent de Llobregat, a town near Barcelona.
Okay. I am Claudia Bellan, and I'm naturally from Badalona. It's next to Barcelona, but I'm a Giants dancer from Sant Climent de Llobregat too.
Cool. In Catalan, we call us gigantes. Mm-hmm. It's the people who dance the giants in the street during the main festivities of a town or village, and we carry the giants, and especially in the main square of the town, mm-hmm. of the village, we do some dances to celebrate the festivity, mm-hmm. and because the people could see it. And the tradition has changed. We have the first reference of a giant in Europe is from the 15th century. So in that moment, the giants appears in the religious processions and represents biblical personalities. And nowadays, the giants are completely different, represents personalities or important things about a town. And this is one change that the meaning of the giants changed along the history. And nowadays, the new things we do with the giants are some shows or some performance with other groups of dancers and in the stage, in theaters, with music and other things. But we also go around the street and in the parades that are the essential activity of the Giants.
No, and in general, we hope that people that dance with Giants or is in a group of Giants care for this tradition and this actuality too, because there are some groups or there are different types of groups, of course, and it's like a little bit complicated the way that you have to represent this tradition and this culture. And we hope that people cares about this tradition and this culture, and can play with the in the right way this type of activities.
In thinking about culture, anthropologists are very well aware that culture doesn't stay the same, and it's really easy to put out the perception that it does when we're talking about a group, especially when we look at the Gigantes de San Clemente, because we would expect that this is some sort of tradition that's been ongoing for generations, countless generations, and in many ways it has, but in subtle ways it has changed and become different. As Adam had pointed out before, the Gigantes had changed from having a more religious sort of connotation to that of representing more broader themes like work outside of everyday life and culture. So it's important to recognize how that type of shift is not just something that takes place because, well, today we don't want this representation to be religious anymore. We want to represent work. That takes time. And that gets down to how we transmit culture. And when we teach culture through enculturation, learning what you do as you grow, being a part of the culture as an insider, everything changes generationally, slowly.
I think it's important to see that with both the Gigantes and with the artwork of Ruben, that it invokes both sentimental value, but also it invokes a skill that needs to be taught and transmitted. And with all things within culture, culture is shared, is transmitted to ensure its survival and to ensure that it is maintained within the patrimony of the community.
I think you need to be very educated. You need to know so much and filter it. Like when I work with my students, like this, for example, they have no experience in calligraphy, right? Mm-hmm. Even guys who know how to draw well does not necessarily know how to do this well, because it requires a muscle memory. Mm-hmm. They just don't have it.
Yeah.
And of course, those that know how to draw, if they try this, they will come about very quickly. But the little kids, for example, no kids, I say 16, 17, I need to go down to the level of explaining to them why this line under this angle is not beautiful, the line under this angle is more beautiful. Ask them, is this beautiful? She says, yes. I say, explain it to me. She cannot.
Yeah.
How? Why is it beautiful? I'm asking, is this ugly? She says, yeah. I say, explain it to me. And she cannot explain it to me, why is this ugly? So you need to go down to the golden section, to the rules of proportion, that level, to explain to them the visual world is a world of, if it's harmonic, dynamic, expressive, then it's good. When it's repetitive, it's boring. When it's uniform, not necessarily a good thing. You know, diversity is good, etc.
I was lucky. I was born to a painter. My dad was an artist, and I was born in a house, you know, filled with books and about art, philosophy, history, and a lot of literature. But I haven't drawn anything until I turned like 16, and when I was supposed to go to study, my dad just asked me, well, what would I like to do? I told him that I want to study history, so he kind of laughed at me and said, well, you know, you're going to spend most of your time in the libraries. Are you really that type of person? And I said, well, no, I don't think so. So actually, it was a kind of a natural choice to study art, and I went on. I did my first degree in painting, and then graphic art, graphic prints, like, you know, I Ching and Linocut, yes, and all that technique. But then our family circumstances have changed. In 93, we left Armenia. Hmm. We went to Israel because my dad needed a medical treatment there. So, and there, actually, I was 21. So my life kind of took a completely different turn, and I ended up in Tel Aviv. Hmm. Which is a fantastic city for an artist, filled with Bauhaus architecture, and you know, it's a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So I started working as a graphic designer because that was a natural choice.
Yeah.
I always loved poster design. I studied for one more year and then started working, and basically for about 25 years I've been practicing graphic design.
How did you two get involved in this art form? Was it something that was a part of your family, or is
with
it something?
Italians.
Yes.
Yes. Well, we have different stories because, for example, my parents start a group of giants of a group of gigantes. They're in Badalona, in my city. And for example, since I was born, I'm there. I'm inside of the group, and I'm enjoying the traditional culture, but. I started dancing with giants when I was 16. So now, for example, I've been dancing with giants since 5 years ago. So this is my story, but is that my parents started and I get involved in a group.
And my story is that when I was a child, I like very much to see the giants, and I play giants at home with the chairs of
yes.
Yeah, I take it and I dance.
Yes, with
yeah, yeah. And my mother brings me to the group of my town, and since I have 4 or 5 years, I go with the giants group in my town.
Is the group, so you're both in your 20s, is there like a lot of all ages that work on giants? Have you got
this? There are a lot of different ages inside of the group. We have like kids that they play the giants or big heads too, and we have like old people that comes and care of the group and take care of the group, or we have young people that play with giant, or there are in our group in particular, no, but there are a lot of people that play music too in the group. And it's like a group with a lot of different ages, and it's so interesting to can interact with them.
Yeah. Is there, so it's kind of like there sounds like there's a sense of community that comes about in this group.
Yes, in Catalonia we have a great tradition of associationism.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's a difficult word.
Yeah, it is.
Around the culture issues. So giants is an example, but we have groups and associations about dances, about painting, about reading. Yes, and in these associations normally everybody is welcome. So there are a lot of different ages and a lot of different capacities. And in a group of gigantes, there are the people who carry the giants, but there are too the people who carry the water for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's important. So everybody has his space in the group.
At the beginning of this episode, we brought up how art shouldn't be made solely for the purpose of making money. And this is a difficult thing to talk about in certain ways, because when we look at the emergence of art as a human phenomenon, as part of culture, we see that art is intimately connected with free time. And as humans are able to create different types of means of freeing up time through domestication of animals, through cultivating grains and domesticating plants as well, we see that more free time is added up, right? And today we might think of, well, time is money. So we can connect in these moments with more time equals more art. So we want to disentangle this a little bit, though, because today it's more complicated than just time, money, art.
Also, as an artist, I believe that your contribution for art is to society, and it should evoke your joy. It should be used to solve problems. And it, in some ways, in the case of Ruben, it could be used to make the world a better place. And it gets lost in sort of that capitalistic endeavor if you're just solely producing art to make money. And that's to be understood. Artists need to, they need to make a living, they need to eat. But that, I don't think that reflects necessarily the skill, and it doesn't necessarily reflect their intent.
The challenge comes in there when it's like, how does that idea fit in with producing art for art's sake in its own level, or producing art for money, right? And so this is where we see this uncomfortable relationship. And that's why there's a lot of cultural baggage, we mentioned before, of the idea of Western commodification of art, right? And that's where a lot of people, an artist would rebel against that idea. And so as we'll see with Claudia and Ruben here to close out, that there is both a idea that, you know, this is not just about trying to pay rent. It's not just about making a product to sell, but there is a relationship that has to be dealt with when it comes to money.
So is it primarily so it's kind of a mix of economic activity and ritual activity. Is that correct? Or
Yes. And we try to do things that people can be interested in. Because, of course, we have a tradition, but we have an actuality too. And we think that it's important to combine it. And it's the thing that we are trying to do in the world of traditional culture.
I've been always a bit ambivalent about the connection between money and art. And we have all learned a bitter lesson what is happening when you make art for purpose of making money. Actually, these two things are not mutually, they cannot live next to one another, because money cannot be the reason why you make art. It can be sold, and artwork can be sold and should be sold, because artists need to make a living, but he should never make art to make money. That kind of defies the entire purpose of making art. I always say this, and probably it's important to take a note of it, is that art is a mirror of the society. You want to understand the society, look at the art it's producing. If it's confused, if it's disoriented, if it's an art that doesn't know itself, is not representative of ideas or how people feel, then it lacks substance. Then it's nothing. It's wallpaper.
So when we think of artwork, we think of the complete composite of it all, but not really the skill that goes into that. And that's what Ruben is teaching with his students. And he's teaching why things are positioned in a certain way, what they evoke, what they mean.
We need to know that the skill plays a crucial place in inability to produce art, which should be collectible, which should be sold for money and hang on the wall. So not everything is worthy to be called art, and we need to understand that.
This is incredibly deep, and it gets at a lot of what I think a lot of anthropologists have struggled with art specifically, because when this initial collection was taking place and trying to understand art from different cultures, a lot of this happened through archaeology or through outsiders coming in and just collecting whatever goods they could find, not discriminating against what was actually important to a culture and what just happened to be a throwaway paper cup. Right? Today, if we look at everything around us, and if an outsider was coming in and understanding our world and our organization, would you pick up a Starbucks cup and say, "This is art"? Now, not just in a postmodern type of sense, but we have to distinguish the capitalistic sort of products that might be considered art someday in a far distant future are not art to us, and that they don't express that deep connection or meaning that we want to convey.
And certainly we see that in the relationship to capitalism for us, right? Like, we're not going to think that a Starbucks cup is art because it's made to carry coffee that you buy and then throw away, right? And so I think that's also what Ruben's kind of getting at in this way too. It's that if you're producing it solely to be sold, and which sounds funny to talk about it as a cup, right? But I think that's a great example, that
then it, that like somehow doesn't count. Like there may be art on the cup, right? There's a nice logo for Starbucks and typography and line and color and spacing and stuff, but that is not art, it seems, right? In this definition. So I think it's actually really a wonderful way to sort of close out the episode, because we've kind of raised the idea with the anthropologists have had trouble kind of expressing and or defining what art is. And as we can see here, it's like artists may set some boundaries and other times not, but like it's this like continuously shifting boundary, right? And so it definitely does seem that in this regard that capitalism and the idea of selling and money is one place that we might draw that boundary.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you want to learn more about the speakers that we showcased today, for Ruben, you can find more on his work, his calligraphy, at armeniancalligraphy.com. And for the Gigantes de San Clement, you can find their page on Facebook, and we encourage you to go do so, like it, and share your support.
This series has been a collaboration between the American Anthropological Association, the Smithsonian Center for Folk Life and Cultural Heritage, as well as the Smithsonian Folk Life Festival and this AnthroLife podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Adam Gamwell.
I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Leslie Walker.
Interviews for this series have been recorded and produced by Adam Gamwell and Leslie Walker on location in Washington, D.C., and today's episode has been produced and engineered by Adam Gamwell in Missing Link Studios. Thanks for listening.